I can always tell when I'm speaking somewhere if there are dispensationalists in the crowd, because when I come back after the first break, they're all gone. I guess they're acting out the rapture for me. But I think what they're really doing is saying, we thought you were going to tell us who the Antichrist was. All right, we're ready for our second message on the Great Tribulation. We're returning to our analysis of Matthew chapter 24. But remember, as we get started, verse 34 is fundamentally important. Jesus says, truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. He is talking about that generation, the generation that was so significant throughout all the book of Matthew. Remember, this, they were men who wanted to see what you see and they don't see it. That generation, they're asking about that temple and those stones, when they will be destroyed. They ask a question about the destruction of those stones in that temple, and Jesus is giving them the answer to that, and we know that temple was destroyed in the year 70, so it did happen in that generation. We noted also that the wars and rumors of wars fit. We noticed that the persecution fit, famines fit, apostasy, all these things have fit. But so far, that's the easy stuff. We've got some tough things coming up. Difficulties remain. I'm going to study these seriatim, and I want to study them in the form of seven questions. These are objections that are usually brought against this AD 70 view, which is called preterism. Preterism means past. It's from the Latin word preteritus, which means passed by, and it means something that is past already. Preterist approach to prophecy is recognizing that some prophecies have already passed and been fulfilled. And those are such as this one in Matthew 24, where it says it'll happen in this generation. That's why we know that it's past. But some questions remain. Let's look at these questions. Let's consider the first one. Was the gospel preached in all the world? Was the gospel preached in all the world? That's what we want to ask. Chapter 24, verse 14 says, this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in a whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. Now, I have already said that all things in this passage up to verse 34 is going to take place in this generation. But here Jesus says, the gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world to all the nations, then the end will come. This is a very popular objection against the preterist viewpoint. It seems quite formidable. Wayne House and Thomas Ice say this, quote, if we look closely at Matthew 24:14, we notice that there are two phrases which modify shall be preached, in the whole world and to all the nations. In the first phrase, the adjective whole indicates that it is the world in its totality that is in view. Are they saying, he's talking about people that hold my view, are they saying that the gospel was preached before AD 70 in the Western Hemisphere? Well, how can we answer such a question? It seems to be a potent objection, doesn't it? But beauty's only skin deep and ugly's to the bone. We're going to see this is an ugly argument. It's not going to work at all. And I think once I get through it, you'll say, yes, I see what you're talking about. We'll start off with something more general and get to something more specifically. I'm going to argue that the word world does not mean the whole globe, the whole world, earth that we live on, but it means the Roman Empire. And I'm going to give you two examples. Luke 2:1, in those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. Would House and Ice ask Luke, did this mean that the Romans sent out a decree to register the Western Hemisphere? Well, to ask it is, you're already laughing at it. Very clearly, it doesn't mean that. Acts 24, verse 5. We have the Jews that have brought Paul on trial here. He says, we have found this man a plague, a creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Was Paul stirring up Jews over here in the Western Hemisphere? No. It's throughout the Roman world. We must also notice that this is clearly fulfilled in the New Testament. Now consider this. Romans 1:8. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for y'all. Notice he was a southerner, for y'all. for you all that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. Would ice and house ask whether the faith of the Romans was spread throughout the whole world? The testimony of the Romans was heard throughout the world? No. It says the same language. The whole world is here. By the way, I keep referring to house and ice. Just a, kind of a side note here. It's a historical interest thing. House and ice wrote their book against this view that I'm presenting and some other things. And later, Dr. House, Wayne House, said he regretted having written the book. It was not done well. And he apologized to me for it. In fact, I saw him when I spoke at Criswell College in 2013. He was one of the speakers there, and I was a speaker. And he said, you know, I regret we ever did that book. It was not well done, and I apologize. He's a real nice fellow. Of course, the other guy's a nice fellow, too. But Dr. House recognized the arguments weren't what they should have been. Well, consider Colossians 1, verses 6 and 23. The gospel has come to you, as it has also in all the world, and is bringing forth fruit as it is also among you since the day you heard and knew the grace of God in truth. And listen to verse 23. If indeed you continue in the faith, grounded and steadfast, and are not moved away from the hope of the gospel which you heard, which was preached to every creature under heaven. That sounds universal, doesn't it? But it's not. It's like we might say, my world's collapsing. That doesn't mean people will start to run and hide. Oh, no, I live in the same world they do. The whole thing's falling apart. No, it's to be understood in its context. The Bible says the gospel was preached in the whole world. It says that the testimony of the Romans was heard throughout the whole world. That obviously is speaking of the Roman world. It is not speaking universally of the whole globe on which we live, the earth. Therefore, Matthew 24, verse 14, has been fulfilled. The gospel was a witness to all the nations in the whole world in the way that it's spoken of in Scripture. Secondly, what and where was the abomination of desolation? The abomination of desolation. Verse 15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place. Now, the popular conception is that this abomination of desolation has something to do with the Antichrist in a rebuilt temple. And this is the abomination of desolation in the future great tribulation, in their view. Well, again, we must interpret this contextually. According to the literary context and the historical temporal context, we have to look at the passage and understand it the way it was written, the way it was uttered at first, and then written in the first century. And we must, this must have occurred in the first century for several reasons. Notice the contextual evidence. Capital A, the contextual evidence. A temple was standing in a holy place. A temple was standing in a holy place at that time. Matthew 27, 53 tells us that, about the temple in the holy city. His audience could imagine no other referent. When Jesus is talking about this abomination happening, standing in the holy place, and he's sitting at the foot of the Mount of Olives, in view of the temple, his disciples could have thought of no other more holy place than the temple of God. And he's definitely talking about that holy temple in that holy city. Notice also, Christ states this regarding observations on that very temple. Observations on that very temple. Again, verse 24, verse 1. Jesus came out from the temple and was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. He's talking about that temple. And a Jew would say, the holy place is what? That temple. All through the Old Testament, even into the New Testament, the temple is the holy place. It's the house of God. Thirdly, Christ points to that very temple in reply. He points to that very temple in reply. When they pointed out the temple buildings, he points back to that temple and says, see you not all these things? Do you not see all these things? All these stones that you're pointing to me, you see them all? And then it declares, truly I say to you, not one stone here will be left upon another which will not be torn down. You're looking at the temple, the beautiful, majestic temple of God. Not one stone here is going to be left on another that will not be thrown down. This beautiful, large temple is going to be destroyed. He's telling them. And this abomination of desolation that stands in the holy place must have something to do with the holy place where the temple is. Fourthly, Josephus similarly describes the temple's destruction. In other words, he uses some language that has to do with desolation when he talks about the temple. Now, Josephus uses the verb form that Jesus uses a noun for. Jesus says eramathē, which means desolation, the abomination of desolation. Well, Josephus uses the verb form of that when he talks about the temple, and he says in Jewish War 6:10:1, thus was Jerusalem taken. This was the second time of its desolation. There's that word again. Jesus talks about the abomination of desolation. When Josephus is writing about the destruction of the temple, he calls it a desolation. Also, he applies Daniel's prophecy to this. In Antiquities of the Jews 10:11:7, Josephus says, in the very same manner, Daniel also wrote concerning the Roman government and that our country should be made desolate by them. This desolation keeps occurring in Josephus, and it was already there in Jesus. And then fifthly, remember, the statement is controlled by the specific time frame. The statement here is controlled by the specific time frame. How many girls in here are left-handed? There's one right before me. There's one right there. I see you. The last three male gentry born in my family are left-handed. My youngest son and my two grandsons, they're taking over. You know, left-handed people, you can't even tell them from other people sometimes. Giving these girls a hard time. But I have to introduce you to my boys. All right. The statement is controlled by the specific time reference. Matthew 24:34. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass till all these things take place. He says in verse 15 something about an abomination of desolation in the holy place. The holy place is the temple. The abomination of desolation is an event. And he says all these things will take place in this generation. Now, consider the historical meaning, capital B, the historical meaning. What is the abomination of desolation? The desolation of the holy city and temple by the Romans is what's being referred to here. It's helpful to look at Luke 21, verse 20. Now remember, Luke is a Gentile. Matthew is a Jew. Matthew speaks in a Hebraic way and uses Hebraic terminology. Well, Luke, when he records what Jesus says, he's going to rephrase it in terms of something that Gentiles could understand. And so this phrase, the abomination of desolation from Daniel, Luke is going to rephrase, and notice what he says. Luke 21:20. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near. You see, he takes the abomination of desolation and rephrases it to the Roman armies surrounding the temple and the city and desolating it. Now the Romans circled the city three times before it was finally destroyed. Don't worry about this, I'm not going to give a pop quiz. Cestius Gallus was a Roman general and procurator in the area. He came down to put down the Jewish revolt in the early stages of it, but he failed and retreated back. And then Nero heard of this, so Nero had to commission Vespasian to come down. Vespasian circles it and is about ready to destroy it when Nero is killed in the Roman civil wars, so Vespasian has to go back to Rome to fight and end up becoming the emperor. So then he sends his son Titus back, and Titus surrounds it for the third time and then finally destroys it. Titus determined that the Romans, quote, and I'm going to be reading this from Jewish War 5:12, Numbers 1 through 3, Titus determined that the Romans must build a wall around the whole city, and when Titus therefore had encompassed the city with this wall and put garrisons into proper places. He went around the wall at the first watch of the night, so all hope of escaping was now cut off from the Jews, together with their liberty of going out of the city. So on the third circling of the city, the third wall built around it, they're trapped. So it's obviously going to have to be that the Christians, when they see the army surrounding Jerusalem, that must have been when Cestius Gallus surrounded it. Cestius Gallus failed and went back, and then Nero had to send others in to do the job. So Jesus says, when you see this happening, flee to Judea, or flee Judea to the mountains. And as a matter of fact, they do that. We have historical records that they did that. But what's interesting is, keep in mind, Matthew, citing Daniel, a very Jewish book, calls it Abomination of Desolation. Luke writes the same prophecy, but he rephrases it so Gentiles can understand what's going on. It's when the Roman armies surround the city to desolate it. The holy place is going to be desolate, is what's being taught here. Now, leading up to that era, there's an internal struggle within Jerusalem. And the Abomination of Desolation well sums up not only what the Romans do, but what the Jews themselves are doing to their temple. In Jewish War 4:5-1, Josephus says, "The outer temple was all of it overflowed with blood, and that day as it came on saw 8,500 dead bodies there." That's because the Jews, while the Romans have them surrounded, the Jews are engaged in civil war. They're parted into three factions. That'll become relevant in the book of Revelation when we talk about that tomorrow. But they're fighting among themselves, and they're killing themselves, and the temple has blood flowing down it. The temple of God, which was to be kept pure and holy and undefiled, now has the bodies of dead men in it and blood flowing all down its steps. And the Jews themselves are causing this. The Jewish zealots cause great harm within. Jewish War 5:1-2 says, "The temple was defiled everywhere with murders." Excuse me. The temple was defiled everywhere with murders. And then he tells us in 5:1-3, "They went out over the buildings and the temple itself and fell upon the priests and those that were at their sacred offices." Now think of this. The holy place, abomination of desolation. The priests are in there conducting their holy rituals, and the zealots come in there and kill the priests, and their blood is now flowing mingled with the sacrificial offerings. This is an abomination of desolation that is leading up to the Romans circling the city and coming in and doing something even more abominable. Let's read about that. Titus commits the final act of abomination in the temple, because what happens is the Roman soldiers come into the temple, they put their incense with the eagle on it, SPQR, the Senate and population of Rome, which was worshipped by the Roman legions. They came in and put their incense up against the temple, and they bowed down and worshipped the Roman Empire in the place where God was to be worshipped. Let's hear what Josephus says, Jewish War 6:6-1. "The Romans, upon the flight of the seditious into the city, and upon the burning of the holy house itself, and of all the buildings lying round about it, brought their incense to the temple, and set them over against the eastern gate. And there they did offer sacrifices to them, and there did they make Titus imperator with the greatest acclamations of joy." Where God was to be worshipped, Rome was to be worshipped. Where God was to be praised, Titus was being praised. That is the abomination of desolation. The temple where the worship of God was to be conducted is now the place where the Roman pagan worship is happening. Clearly, the AD 70 events are very relevant to the original audience. The Jews who had denied Christ are now reaping what they sowed. Remember, they said, "His blood be upon us and our children." This is what is happening in AD 70. And it eventuates in this abomination of desolation after the Roman armies surround it and then come in and offer pagan worship there. Thirdly, was the Jewish war the worst ever? Was it the worst ever? Verse 21 says, "Then there will be a great tribulation such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will be." Well, this is one of those tough questions that arises. Was AD 70 the worst war of all times? This is a major complaint against it. Charles Feinberg has written, when he compares 80-70 to World War I and World War II, he says, who can legitimately equate them with Matthew 24:21? He's saying, what we have here is the World War II and World War I, well, surely they were worse than the Jewish War, and you can't even compare the two, he would say. John Walvoord says of the Great Tribulation, it's a time of unprecedented trial. It is a time of unprecedented trouble, a trial that would exceed any judgment of the past or the future. In fact, never in the history of the world has there been the destruction of human life described here. What is more, the trials and difficulties of that day would be so severe that it would exterminate the entire race, human race, if it were not for the fact that they were cut short because of the return of Christ. Well, how are we going to respond? If we say the Great Tribulation occurred in the first century, right there in the text where it says the Great Tribulation occurs, it says it's the worst tribulation of all history. How can we respond? Well, here's the answer. First, the context demands it. Verse 34 says all these things will happen to this generation. To me, that should settle it, because it does say, after that event, it does say all these things, as if he's looking back over everything he's just said, all these things I just told you will happen in this generation. But notice also the context rebuts the modern argument. The context rebuts the modern argument. John Walvoord is absolutely wrong when he says the Great Tribulation, which I believe is AD 70, will exceed any judgment of the past or the future. He says, let's look at it in his terms first. And I'm going to go back and explain some things I just said. In the Great Tribulation, according to dispensationalism, one-third of the world population dies. You probably have heard that figure before if you've heard some of this dispensational teaching. One-third of the world population dies. That would be worse than AD 70, wouldn't it? Maybe 1 million Jews died. How are we going to explain that if there's a Great Tribulation in our future, a third of the world dies, they've got their one-third of the world, and all we have is the 1 million Jews in the first century? How can I defend my view on this basis? Again, context. Because he says, Jesus says, this is the Great Tribulation, the worst ever, and the dispensationalists say that one-third of the world dies. Well, look in the context, verse 38 and 39. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. Guess how many in the world died in the Noahic flood? Every single person except for Noah's family, 8 people. Now, which is worse, one-third of the world or the entire world? This is talking about not only so, but it takes out all the animals, all the air-breathing animals except the ones on the ark. Something else is going on here in this text. Let's consider the literary style supports it. The literary style supports it, that is, supports my view here. And so what I'm saying is, when the dispensationalist says, look off to the future, there's a Great Tribulation coming where one-third of the world dies, nothing like that's ever happened. I said, well, yes, it did. In the days of Noah, the entire world except for one family died. And so that doesn't even compare to that. Let's notice the literary style. The major problem, though, is that modern Christians are unfamiliar with Old Testament language. The Old Testament prophetic language is often hyperbolic. Consider this. Matthew 24:21 says there will never be another time like this. Exodus 11:6, talking about the 10th plague. Then there shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as was not like it before, nor ever shall be like it again. Well, if the future Great Tribulation is to be the worst ever, and there will never be anything like it before or after, what about the 10th plague? He says they'll cry out as something that's never like that happened before or after. Ezekiel 5:9. I will do among you what I've never done, and the like of which I will never do again because of all your abominations. He destroyed the temple in the Old Testament, and it was rebuilt. in the New Testament. And then it was destroyed again. See, the language, God has the language of the Babylonian destruction of the temple in this hyperbolic language. I will never do anything like this again. But then he does in the New Testament. Now let's notice this. Now that you might try to worm your way out of it. I'm not going to let you. Look what happens here. Do I have these texts in your notes there, 2 Kings? Look at this. 2 Kings 18:5, talking about Hezekiah. He trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that after him there was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor among those that were before him. Would you say he's the best king ever and nobody could compare? Well, look at the same thing said about Josiah in 2 Kings 23:25, the same book. Before him there was no king like him who turned to the Lord with all his heart and with all his soul, with all his might, according to the law of Moses, nor did any like him arise after him. Well, which one's the best king? In both places, in the same book, they say of Hezekiah and of Josiah, the best ever. Nobody before or after could be any better. This is hyperbolic language. It's not a lie. It's a language of exaltation. It's simply saying, this is a good king. But as a matter of fact, there is coming another good king. And so what we have to understand is the Bible sometimes speaks with hyperbole, with exaggeration, for dramatic effect. It's not a literal statement that you can quantify mathematically, necessarily. Fourthly, did Christ come like lightning? Verse 27. For just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. Again, you have to read this contextually. Notice what he's speaking about and the connection. Look at the preceding verse, verse 26. If they say to you, behold, he is in the wilderness, do not go out. Or behold, he is in the inner room, do not believe them. And so here in verse 27, Jesus is going to dismiss these false expectations. He's saying, don't listen to these people. Notice, he says, my coming will be unmistakable. For, verse 27, for just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. Don't believe people when they say he's here or there. You'll know it, because when I come again, it's going to be like a lightning bolt. And so that's what he's saying there. Okay? All right? Now we come to another toughie. Number five, did the stars fall? Verse 29, did the stars fall? Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. John Walvoord says, the great dispensational scholar, there will be other unusual phenomena occurring in connection with the second coming of Christ. He says the second coming will be preceded by many supernatural events in the skies. And he cites Matthew 24:29 here. These supernatural events, the stars falling from the sky. Notice that he says the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. How do we explain this? A meteor shower? Solar eclipse? Or what? Again, this is dramatic, apocalyptic Old Testament language. It's dramatic hyperbole, and I can demonstrate it. In Isaiah 13, I believe I have this in your notes there for you. Isaiah 13, verses 10 through 13, we read this. See how similar this prophecy sounds to Matthew 24. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. There's the same language. The sun will be darkened. There's that language, and it's going forth. And the moon will not cause its light to shine. I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will halt the arrogance of the proud and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. I will make a mortal more rare than fine gold, a man more than the golden wedge of Ophir. Therefore, I will shake the heavens and the earth will move out of her place and the wrath of the Lord of hosts and in the day of his fierce anger. What is he talking about? Well, look at verse 1. The burden against Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos saw. This is a prophecy against Old Testament Babylon. And then notice verse 17. Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them who will not regard silver, and as for gold, they will not delight in it. In verse 19, in Babylon, the glory of the kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. Now think of this. In verses 10 through 13, the stars are falling, the sun's not shining, the moon's not shining, the earth is shaking out of her place. But he says, and also you got to worry about the Medes and Persians. No, why would anybody be worried about the Medes if this is happening in the stellar universe? You don't worry about some army coming. They've got to worry about the stars collapsing on them, don't they, the Medes? This is dramatic, hyperbolic language. It's speaking of the collapse of a civilization. Now remember, in Genesis 1:14, God set the sun and the moon in the sky to govern the day and night. So in Scripture, the sun and moon are symbols of government. Like in our flag, we've got 50 stars that represent the 50 state governments. I mean, that's held widely throughout history, but it's in the Bible too as well. Well, what's happening is the stars falling represents the collapse of the government. Their world is falling apart as their government leaders are destroyed, as their nation falls apart. That's what this is symbolizing. The same thing is true for Edom. Look at Isaiah 34, verses 3 through 5. Their slain shall be thrown out. Their stench shall rise from their corpses, and the mountains shall be melted with their blood. Now, do you think the mountains are really going to be melted with blood? No, this is hyperbolic, dramatic, poetic language. There is not going to be enough people in the world with enough blood to melt the mountains. And then it says, all the hosts of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled up like a scroll, and all their hosts shall fall down as the leaf falls of the vine. All their hosts. Is he saying literally that all the stars of the universe will fall down to the earth? And then he says, for my sword shall be bathed in heaven, indeed it shall come down on Edom. Once again, Isaiah 13 was talking about Babylon and the collapse of their government. Isaiah 34 is Edom and the collapse of their government. And so this is hyperbolic language speaking of the collapse of a government. The sign of a star is a symbol of government. Remember, the star shall rise out of Jesse? It's talking about David. The son of David going to rise to be the ultimate ruler? Sixth question. How did Christ come in the clouds? Now, I was asked this a few moments ago in the break, so we'll get to that now. I think this is the one we were talking about. The Olivet, actually, it was the preceding one that you asked about. I've already dealt with it, so you can go back to sleep. His eyes were flying at half-mast anyway. Just kidding. The Olivet Discourse is a judgment on Jerusalem. How will they see the Son of Man coming in the sky? Well, the King James Version, Matthew 24:30, I actually like better, says, then there will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Note well, it first says, then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. It doesn't say, then will appear the Son of Man. But then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Which means to say, he's not in the tomb over there outside of Jerusalem. The sign of the judgment of the temple is the sign that the Son of Man is in heaven. He is resurrected and ascended into heaven. He is not there in the tomb. That's what he's saying in the first part of this verse. But then it goes on to say, then you'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. Again, this is apocalyptic language, judgment language, strong language. And it has a parallel with this. Now notice what Jesus says to the high priest, Matthew 26:64. Jesus said to him, it is as you said, nevertheless I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Excuse me. He's talking directly to the high priest. He's on trial for his life there, and he looks the high priest in the eye and says, nevertheless, I tell you, you will see the Son of Man on the clouds of heaven coming excuse me, in power. What is going on here is this is another symbolic, apocalyptic, poetic language event. The clouds are symbols of judgment. Have you ever had a tornado down here in this area? When you have. Apparently, I brought up something we should not talk about. When you see those dark clouds coming, that's scary. And so a cloud is a symbol of judgment. And Jesus is going to be judging the temple, and he's saying, the clouds of God's judgment are coming through me, the Son of Man. For instance, in Lamentations 2:1, we have these words, how the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger. He didn't really cover them with a cloud, but it's the judgment concept that he's speaking about. Ezekiel 30, verse 3, the day is near, even the day of the Lord is near. It will be like a day of clouds, a time of doom for the nations. Ezekiel 30, verse 18, in Tihaphnehes, the day will be dark when I break the yoke bars of Egypt. Then the pride of her power will cease in her, a cloud will cover her, and her daughters will go into captivity. He's not really saying it's going to be a cloudy day that day. You're not going to get much good sun. He's giving an image. This judgment cloud, when you see here in Alabama, the dark clouds forming something that could issue forth in a tornado, it's a bad sign. Well, likewise, he's saying a judgment coming is against you. A cloud judgment is coming against you. Ezekiel 38, verse 9 of Gog, it says, you will go up, you will come like a storm, you will be like a cloud covering the land, you and your troops. See, he's telling the armies of Gog are going to be like a cloud covering the land. The Roman armies coming into Jerusalem are effectively a cloud of judgment coming upon the land. Joel 2, verses 1 and 2 says basically the same thing. And a very similar passage to Matthew 24, verse 30 is found in Isaiah 19:1. Isaiah 19:1 says, the oracle concerning Egypt, this is in the Old Testament, the oracle concerning Egypt, behold, the Lord is riding on a swift cloud and is about to come to Egypt, and the idols of Egypt will tremble at his presence, and the heart of the Egyptians will melt within him. Now let me ask you, did God in the Old Testament literally get on a cloud and ride down into Egypt and knock over their idols? No. This is judgment language. This is poetic, dramatic, hyperbolic language that speaks of great devastation. And just like a storm cloud comes, he's saying, God is in that cloud. God is going to destroy you. In fact, Matthew 24, verse 30, cites Daniel 7:13. But notice what Daniel 7:13 is talking about. Daniel 7:13 says, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days. The coming of the Son of Man is the coming up to heaven to receive power and glory, and because he is in heaven, the sign is that the Son of Man is in heaven. Because he's in heaven, he's bringing this judgment upon Israel for rejecting him. So, again, we're seeing that this is symbolic, poetic, dramatic language because of the way it's used throughout Scripture, because of what these symbols represent by themselves, but when they're clustered together like this in judgment passages, we can feel the power of what is being talked about. So then, what is the sign that the Son of Man is at the right hand of God? The sign is the destruction of the temple. The high priest of the temple judged Jesus and destroyed him, and he is the temple. He said, in 3 days, you destroy this temple, in 3 days I'll raise it up. He is the true temple. They destroyed that temple, and Jesus destroyed their temple. And the sign is that the Son of Man is in heaven. The one that you destroyed is in heaven while you're here upon the earth, and he's destroying your temple. That's really effectively what's going on. Now notice the whole reason for the Olivet Discourse, again, verses 2 and 3, he said to them, do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here will be left upon another, which will not be torn down. As he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, tell us, when will these things happen? And then four verses after Matthew 24, verse 30, four verses later, he says, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass until all these things take place. And so again, we see how it fits. Seventhly, seventh question and final question. What is the gathering of the elect? Matthew 24:31 says, "He will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other." This seems to refer to the second advent, the angels, the trumpet, the gathering. And this language can fit literally to the second advent. I do believe Jesus is coming. He will come in great glory. He will gather us up to be with him. But A.D. 70 is kind of a small picture of the second coming. It's a distant adumbration, it's called. It is a day of Lord in, of the Lord in history that is a small picture of what is coming at the end of history. But we're looking at this judgment here in A.D. 70. What is going on here? I want us to make two important notations as we begin. The first is this. Three verses later, he says, all these things will happen to this generation. Never forget that. How could you? I've mentioned it so much you're sick of it. Secondly, the lexical point here. The word angel in the Greek is angelos, which simply means messenger. It can mean the angelic messenger of God, Gabriel, Michael, whatever. But it can speak of human messengers, as it does in Matthew 11:10, Mark 1:2, Luke 7:24. For instance, Luke 7:20-24. When the men came to him, they said, "John the Baptist has sent us to you to ask, 'Are you the expected one, or do we look for someone else?' When the messengers, the angeloi, angels, when the messengers of John had left, he began to speak to the crowds about John." And so you see, the word angel can mean messenger. So then, how do we explain this verse? When he sends his messengers with the great trumpet, what's going on? Well, you're probably getting the suspicion here that I'm talking about gospel ministers will go out into all the world with the message of the gospel. But what's the trumpet have to do with it? Well, the trumpet is picked up from the year of Jubilee in the Old Testament, Leviticus 25. The ram's horn was sounded. In Leviticus 25, verses 9 and 10, we read these words. "You shall then sound a ram's horn." By the way, this is the same in the Greek version of the Old Testament. It's the same word as in the Greek New Testament. "You shall then sound a ram's horn abroad on the 10th day of the 7th month. On the Day of Atonement, you shall sound a horn throughout all the land. You shall thus consecrate the 50th year and proclaim a release throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, and each of you shall return to his own property, and each of you shall return to his family." The year of Jubilee was a time when all the debts of Israel were forgiven. Every 50th year it was to happen. All debts forgiven. That is a type, a symbol of our debt being forgiven in Jesus Christ. And so this trumpet sounding is a picture of the sounding of the ultimate Jubilee. It's the trumpeting forth of the gospel of Jesus Christ to declare true salvation through him. Interestingly, Isaiah 61 picks up on Leviticus 25, the year of Jubilee. And Jesus reads from Isaiah 61 when he's in Luke 4:19 in the synagogue. And he says, he is there to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord. This is that language from the year of Jubilee, which is the favorable year of the Lord. Jesus says in the synagogue there in Nazareth, while he's standing up reading from the scroll of Isaiah, he's quoting from that passage which refers to the year of Jubilee, and he's saying he is there to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord. He has brought in salvation. As Christianity is freed from Judaism in the first century, it goes out to all the world and proclaims the forgiveness of debt to God. And so what's happening here is an image of the gospel preachers being sent out into all the world under the year of Jubilee imagery, the declaration of forgiveness of sins in Jesus Christ. The gathering of the elect is simply the gathering of a new body. No longer are the true believers to be gathered into Israel. They're to be gathered into the church, the ecclesia of God. Hebrews 10:25 says of the church that we're not to forsake the gathering of ourselves together. And this church here has been gathered. You have been gathered by the work of the gospel. And at the collapse of Israel, at the collapse of the temple in Jerusalem, the church is free to go out into all the world. It had already started before then, of course, but now it's totally free from all constraints. Paul and the Christians don't have to go back to the temple and do all this, that, and the other with the temple. And they go out into all the world to gather in the elect from the four winds, from all over the earth, from one end of heaven to the other. That is, as you look west, you'll see the sunset over there. You look east, you'll see the sun rise over there. The heaven touches there, and it touches there from one end of heaven to the other is being covered. In other words, everywhere in the world. And so the angelic witness speaks of gospel messengers going out and declaring the great jubilee of God. We don't use that language hardly ever today. But the fact is, if we were to look at the year of Jubilee in the Old Testament and recognize it's a picture of the coming salvation of Jesus Christ's work on the cross, then we could use that language effectively to declare the Jubilee of God in Jesus Christ. And we go out throughout all the world, leaving Jerusalem and Israel behind and one race. No longer just one race, one city, one temple. We go out into all the world, to all nations. I believe a powerful case can be made for the proposition that the Great Tribulation is past. I believe it's quite biblical, quite historical, quite contextual, and quite reasonable. And you can get a detailed exposition of that in two books over there, the Olivet Discourse Made Easy, and then the other one, I debate the man, Thomas Ice, in the Great Tribulation, Past or Future. He writes his view, I write mine, and we interact with each other. And I've been quoting him several times during this talk tonight. Anyway, that is why I believe the Great Tribulation occurred in the first century, because Jesus tied it to the temple, because he said it happened in this generation, because there were wars and rumors of wars and persecution and famine and sword and apostasy, and because the gospel was preached as a witness in all the world of that day, and all of these other things. It all fits. And it's all under the umbrella. All these things must happen to this generation. I really don't see any way around it.